the Chief Judge and Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good afternoon. This is the time and the place for the oral argument in United States versus Mitchell. And I'm sure that our clerk, Mr. Seiko, has told you that once the court was convened, this room now has become a United States courtroom. And so I'd ask you just to keep that in mind as far as your decorum goes, both during the case itself and in the question and answer period that will follow. We will now hear from the appellant in the case.
Chief Judge Erdman, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Sam Landis, along with Major Annie Shea. I represent the United States. This court should set aside the military judge's ruling for three reasons. First, the investigators did not violate Sergeant Mitchell's Fifth Amendment privilege by asking him to unlock the phone. Second, the investigators did not violate Sergeant Mitchell's Fifth Amendment right to counsel by asking him to unlock the phone. And third, even if either of those rights were violated, the military judge erred in her applying the exclusionary rule. Turning first to the core Fifth Amendment privilege, Sergeant Mitchell's claim of privilege does not pass the three-part test of Hibble. It was not compelled, testimonial, and incriminating. First, it was not compelled. The military judge here made a finding of fact that all the investigators did was to say, could you help us out and unlock the phone? And if not, we'll ask our digital forensic investigator to do so later.
Counselor, does that make it voluntary? Does that make it consensual?
It does make it consensual. It's the question for the core Fifth Amendment privilege is simply whether he was compelled. And the test for that is whether he was faced with two options, one which was speaking and another which was so dangerous or coercive or violative of religious precepts.
Is that
precepts.
The test? Is that the constitutional test? Or is that dictum setting the outer boundaries or speak or be tortured? That's not the constitutional test. It's not speak or be tortured. What is the test? What is the test for compulsion?
The test for compulsion in the sense of the core Fifth Amendment privilege, so not Miranda or the prophylactic rules that surround that privilege, but for the privilege itself, comes from South Dakota versus Neville. And that's what the court said. Not necessarily that it's torturous, but...
Well, that's what you're saying.
That it's dangerous or coercive in some way or violates religious precepts.
Well, coercive is simply circular. It's coercive because it's circular. What's compulsion? What's coercion?
The best that the court explained in Neville was they provide an example of what was not compulsion. What was not compulsion was the DUI motorist in that case who was faced with the choice of taking an alcohol test or having his refusal to do so used against him in court. So that's not unlike the choice that Sergeant Mitchell had in this case, which was to unlock his phone or to have someone else unlock the phone later.
And who was going to unlock it later?
He was told that the DFE would unlock.
Right, and he was told falsely. Right, they lied to him.
At the time
they were disingenuous.
Yes, Your Honor. At that time,
as far as I know from the briefs, that's still the case. You can't get into the thing.
I can represent, and I agree that in the record that's not present in the record, the government does have that capability now. At the time that Sergeant Mitchell unlocked the phone, we were not advancing the claim that we could have at that time.
Right, so they lied to him, but yeah. Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
You have to do this, or we're going to do it anyway, and so then they say, okay, you can do it. I mean, in the Fourth Amendment context, that wouldn't be consensual, would it?
It would, as long as the person's will was not overborne.
Well, that's not correct. I mean, there's at least Bumper versus North Carolina that says the exact opposite, right? I mean, in that case, they had a search warrant, but they relied on his consent. But they had said to him, do you consent to a search? And we have a warrant. He said, yes, I consent. And the Supreme Court said, in that context, if you are acting not because you're truly consenting, but you're basically, you're acquiescing to a authority, that's not voluntary, it's not consensual. So why would we apply a different test in this context?
Because the test that's been applied by the Supreme Court for the Fifth Amendment context, at least, is the Neville test, is the test that was applied in that case. In that case,
but that case is different than this case, right? I mean, it's a different sort of question.
It is slightly different in that the options presented to the suspect are a little bit different, but the level of coercion is not any different. The level of coercion is probably more in Neville, in that he knew that this was going to be used against him if he did not submit to the test. In this case, the accused was just faced with the question of whether he would unlock it now or whether it would be unlocked later.
Counsel, you portray it, though, as if this was a very brief interaction. Can you help us out? Otherwise, we'll go to forensics on this. In fact, didn't it take quite some time and a number of requests?
It did, Your Honor. There was a number of times, and Sergeant Mitchell demonstrated ability to sort of push back and fight back against the government. Not only did they ask...
Fighting back, or is that asserting his constitutional rights?
It could be asserting his constitutional rights, but he has to have a privilege to begin with. It has to be compelled, testimonial, and incriminating. Because it was not, it doesn't matter that he tried to enforce a right that he did not have.
What would you use as the opposite of compelled? Just so that might help me better understand what you mean by compelled.
Simply requested. That's what happened in this case. The military judge found that the language that the investigators used was, could you help us out? Or words to that effect. So compelled versus requested has constitutional significance.
Well, no, it's compelled. It's would you help us out? And if you do not, we'll do it anyway.
Yep.
So yes, cough it up, or we'll do it anyway. The fact that they lied to him he didn't know they were lying to him. How is that not compulsion?
Because even from his perspective, if he were to assume what they were saying was true, that's not an impossible choice, the sort of impossible choice that Neville requires for compulsion to exist, a choice between a dangerous or painful option and the option that he was given.
Well, so now we're back to torture or compliance, but that's not the standard. Come on.
That's what the Supreme Court wrote in Neville.
That's dicta. That's the outer limits. But what is the core? Don't tell me it's torture or talk, or we've got a much bigger problem than we've got in this case.
Yes. So assuming that line is dicta, it appears to be the rule of the case, but assuming that the line is dicta, the sort of follow-on line in that case is that the person would inevitably choose to speak. So some choice between options in which the person would inevitably choose to speak, whether that's because of danger, painfulness, religious precepts, something like that.
Now, if we move on to the second question, why doesn't the Edwards rule apply in this case? And do you agree that if it does apply, that it doesn't matter how we resolve the first issue?
Taking your second question first, I do agree. These questions could be taken in either order. One conceptual approach is that the Edwards is the prophylactic outer rule, and so that question could be taken up first and resolved against the government. But the Edwards was not violated in this case for two reasons. First, Sergeant Edwards was not in custody. And second, the investigators did not badger or coerce him into re-engaging in interrogation, did not ask for his permission to interrogate further.
Well, but the badger or coercion, that's not the best.
It is. We believe it is, Your Honor. There's if you were working with a clean slate after Edwards.
The test is, I wrote it down just to make sure I didn't screw it up. It was, did he invoke, was later in custody, and then was he re-interrogated at a later time? I mean, re-interrogated doesn't mean badger or coerce. It just means, did they ask a question that was likely to elicit a response?
Interrogation is not the test under Maryland versus Schatzer. So here's the line from Maryland versus Schatzer: we are not talking about, quote, interrogating the suspect. So it's some other test, some test other than the Rhode Island versus Innis test. And in Hutchins, this court described that question as entirely separate from the question of interrogation. So it's something else. And what what Schatzer called it was asking for permission to interrogate. So asking to ask questions.
Okay, he was...
How long is going to be long enough that the inherent coercion of being in a custodial sort of situation that you're asked again and again, that you're going to, that basically you didn't get a break, right? So Schatzer was looking at that question, and they came up with a sort of, I mean, I'm sorry, Justice Scalia, but a sort of made up rule of 14 days. Right? So Schatzer has nothing to, that language in Schatzer has nothing to do with the Edwards rule.
That language is arguably dicta, because as you pointed out, the real question in Schatzer was how long must the investigators wait? However, that dicta was part of...
How long temporally is it before the badgering, sort of inherently badgering nature of being asked again and again dissipates?
How long before the investigators can attempt to reinitiate interrogation is the question in Schatzer. In coming to the answer of 14 days, the court discussed what it is that they're talking about. And what they're talking about is not interrogation. It's reinitiation of interrogation by asking permission to ask questions. An obvious example of that is this court's decision in Applewhite, in which the investigators asked if the accused would take a polygraph at her.
So that's, the test is, was he being interrogated? And the definition of interrogation is any words or actions police should know are reasonably likely to elicit an incriminating response. And that's the test. I mean, that's the test in my words. Let's assume that that's the test that we're using. So why, using my test instead of your test, wasn't this a reinterrogation?
Because under cases like United States versus Frazier, Morris, very analogous to a request for consent to search in this case. This request to unlock the phone so that we could search the phone is very analogous to Frazier and Morris, in which there was a request for consent to search the accused belongings. That was not found to be an interrogation. And in this case, we don't have the extraordinary circumstances that were present in Hutchins, in which that accused was isolated for 7 days in a combat zone and unable to speak with anyone, counsel or otherwise.
Well, I cared about that, but I wrote a concurrence, right? The other people didn't care about those circumstances, right?
But
I'm just saying, I'm glad you're on my side, but I was not the majority.
Correct, and the majority did rely on at least to some extent on those circumstances, pointing out the fact-intensive nature of that case and why in this case that amounted to reinitiation of interrogation. But that is the test, the totality of circumstances. It is a fact-intensive
test. Okay, so he's in custody, or you're saying he's not in custody. He's taken to, you know, okay, send him to the CO's office. Is he free to leave the CO's office? I think not. Okay, he's sitting in the CO's office. Here come Keystone and Cops. And they start asking him questions. How is that not a reinitiation of interrogation after he has invoked his right to counsel? It is undenied that he did not have counsel. He was not afforded counsel. Why, I don't know, but he was not afforded counsel. And here they come. And, you know, he's sitting in the CO's office. He's not free to leave. And they start asking him the same questions again.
It's not interrogation because it's not precisely the same questions. What they proposed to do before when he invoked counsel was to ask him questions about the offense. The question they asked when they came back to the CO's office
is, please give us evidence about the offense by opening your phone.
They asked for him to unlock the phone.
They did indeed.
And what was the purpose of that request?
It was to execute their lawful search authorization that they had.
In connection with the offense that they were investigating.
Certainly.
For evidence.
Yes, certainly, Your Honor. But that would be true of Morris. That would be true of Frazier as well. And in those cases, this court held that was not interrogation. When the police officers in those cases asked for consent to search the accused belongings, certainly they were engaged in investigation. So the subjective intent of the police officer is certainly not determinative. The question is whether it was in fact interrogation. And under Morris and Frazier, it's so analogous to a request for consent to search that in this case, under these facts, it's not interrogation.
No. If you've got, give us the PIN or whatever it is, the code. How does that not probe into his thought processes under the cases holding that? And so, you know, it's different from saying, yeah, you can go look in my pile of dirty clothes. There's not much thought process involved there. But now they want information, they want data, they want a particular code that's in there and they don't have and they can't get. So how is that the same?
Importantly, they still don't have it. The government still
doesn't. Well, it's not the point. it's not the point that he didn't mouth it to them. He did say he pushed it in. And then they made him disable the thing, which is a more complex procedure, just to make sure that they could get in there. Now, how is that combination of stuff not a serious probe into one's thought processes?
Because under the Fifth Amendment jurisprudence, it was not an extensive use of the contents of his mind that was communicated.
Hello? It's not an extensive use of the contents of his mind to say, cough up this pen so we can get in there and rummage around for evidence. And by the way, don't just cough up the pen, but disable the phone permanently. I have a real problem with that proposition.
What distinction are you trying to draw between the accused providing the pen orally or in writing as compared to entering the passcode into the phone itself? What distinction are you trying to draw?
One is verbal and one is an act, and that has constitutional significance. If we had ordered him, if we had required him to verbally tell us the PIN or write it down or provide to us the PIN, if that had actually occurred, certainly there would be a violation, but it
so
did
why,
not.
Why would you make that concession? What is that incriminating with respect to? What fact does that prove? This is my PIN number. What's your PIN number? 3572. What does that incriminate him with respect to?
It does not. I'm sorry. No, I was answering the question.
By itself, without anything.
No, nothing. It's not incriminating. I had assumed.
Well, I mean, it incriminates him about this is his PIN number, right?
If that fact were incriminating, certainly that would be something that he implied. I had assumed for the purpose of answering Judge Olson's question that compelled and incriminating was satisfied. It would not be testimonial because it's an act. If it was both compelled and incriminating, and we required him to verbally provide the PIN, then that would be testimonial. It was not testimonial in this case because it was simply an act. And it was an act that did not rely on the extensive use of the contents of his mind. It did not provide to the government some information, or that information was a foregone conclusion. So the only fact that was implied that was passed from the mind of the accused to the government in this case is that he knew the PIN to the phone.
How is it a foregone, or is it the government's position that it's a foregone conclusion?
It is. That,
how? Because the government's wants to rummage around for evidence and presumably doesn't know what's in there. You know, how is that a foregone conclusion under the 11th Circuit holding?
Did they know that was his only cell phone?
They did. They knew that he had. I believe at that time they knew that he only had one. They probably only believed he had one cell phone, Your Honor.
No. How? Where in the record is that? Probably only had one cell phone. I mean, they knew he had a cell phone, but there's no evidence that if in fact he did use it, that was the cell phone that he used. And so then, how can there be a foregone conclusion that they're going to find evidence on it? They might find it nothing.
At the SOS, we would advance the, and I see I'm almost out of time. May I answer your question?
Please.
At the SOS, we would advance what I've been calling the Massachusetts, Florida, and what's been endorsed recently by the Third Circuit view, which is the foregone conclusion test focuses on the single testimonial fact that was transmitted. That was only that he knew the PIN to his phone. And so we knew that he knew the PIN to his phone because that's the only reasonable inference from the fact that he was carrying it in his pocket. Not that it was a very expensive paperweight, but a phone that he could access.
So does that mean that any citizen in the United States is subject to an at-will search by law enforcement because presumably he has a phone and presumably he knows the code to it because otherwise phone would be useless? I mean, what's the implication of that?
It's narrower than that because in this case, for two reasons. One, the primary protection for privacy under the Constitution is the Fourth Amendment. In this case, that was complied with. There was probable cause. There was a proper search authorization. That doesn't apply to every citizen of the country. In this case, also, it was a foregone conclusion that he knew the PIN to this phone. There could be a circumstance in which...
Yeah, my question, of course, is that enough for foregone conclusion? The government's position is that it is.
It is. The reasonable particularity standard that the lower courts have adopted, that certainly meets this test here.
Well, no, yeah, if that's the proper standard, which is another question.
I just wanted to ask, if you can't answer the question, now you can answer it on rebuttal, which is in terms of whether or not this was a whether they were asking for testimony, would your position necessarily be different if the mere fact that he knew, that was able to get into the phone was somehow evidence to use, like whether the question was whether this was his phone?
Counsel, you can answer that on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll now hear from the amicus in support of the appellant.
Mr. Chief Judge Erdman, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Sean Flynn, and I'm arguing as amicus curiae in support of appellant, the United States of America. The military judge's order suppressing the contents of appellee's iPhone should be vacated for two reasons. First, appellee's entry of his passcode was not an act of production. The act of production doctrine should not apply to the entry of a passcode, and the act of production doctrine should not be extended in this case. And second, appellee's entry of his passcode does not satisfy the Supreme Court's three-part test for finding a violation of the Fifth Amendment's right against self-incrimination, most fundamentally because it was not testimonial. The act of production doctrine was first articulated by the Supreme Court in Fisher versus United States. There, a subpoena had ordered the production of incriminating documents. The Supreme Court acknowledged that the production of those documents pursuant to the subpoena may have communicative aspects, such as telling the government the existence, location, and authenticity of the documents. However, in that case, the Supreme Court determined the evidence was admissible because it was a foregone conclusion. In this case, Fisher and the foregone conclusion rationale are inapplicable. That is not at issue here, and we must emphasize that that case was about the production of documents. Appellee is not challenged.
I think that the foregone conclusion doctrine helps you, doesn't hurt you, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The foregone conclusion?
Government was just up arguing that we should apply the foregone conclusion rule.
I would think that would help you, right? Which is, that would be, if what you're asking about is something that they already know, how does that hurt them?
Your Honor, what our purpose here as amici is to have a more clear understanding and a better law. And so, while yes, the government articulated very well that the foregone conclusion would allow the evidence in, we are arguing that it's not necessary in this case. It's unnecessary because the appellee's entry of his passcode did not communicate anything new to the government. The foregone conclusion exception is about neutralizing what would otherwise be a Fifth Amendment violation. When something is determined an act of production, the government must prove that it had knowledge of the location, authenticity, and existence of the documents. Extending that rationale to the electronic age is very difficult, and it will muddy the waters in a way that this court should leave to the Supreme Court to handle.
What if he would have given them the passcode and they entered the passcode?
Your Honor, we would not concede that that would be testimonial. However, that would have been a different case in that it would have given the government insight into the appellee's mind and his way of thinking. It would have given the government insight into the way he comes up with ways to hide his things, and it didn't happen. However, we're not conceding that that would have been testimonial in that case.
What is the constitutional difference between, as Judge Olson asked, what's the constitutional difference between saying, enter the passcode, or we're going to have somebody else do it, and write your passcode on this little piece of paper, and we'll enter it? What is the difference?
The result is certainly the same.
The result is the same. Government gets evidence it would not otherwise have got.
Your Honor,
I'm not talking about foregone conclusion here. I'm talking about this.
Yes, Your Honor. If I understand your question, you're asking what the difference is between the appellee entering the passcode himself and the appellee giving the passcode to the government investigators. Right. So, Your Honor, in that case, I would contend that there is no testimonial act in either way, in that the government was not given access or information about anything it did not already know.
Okay, so you're saying neither. There is no constitutional difference between the two, is what you're saying.
That's, Your Honor, we're not conceding that giving the passcode to the investigators would be a violation. That's correct.
Query. It seems to me that what the appellee is arguing is that somehow the passcode itself becomes testimonial because it then allows them into the iPhone, which then permits them to see things that, but for the passcode, they could not have seen, and that therefore the passcode is being used against him. Can you square that argument or respond to that argument of by appellee in light of Doe versus the United States, which seems to be involved with something that gave the government access, right? Gave by making him sign the form saying, yes, foreign banks or whatever they were, you can provide all these documents. And they said, well, all that, because him signing those documents didn't testify about anything, the fact it gave him access to evidence, that gave them access to evidence, didn't make it testimonial.
Your Honor, the Supreme Court in Doe determined that to be testimonial, a communication must relate a factual assertion or disclose information. And we are arguing that in this case, nothing was disclosed to the investigators that they did not already know. The only thing disclosed by the Pelley's entry of his passcode was that he had access to the phone. And as counsel for the government already made clear, the investigators had knowledge of that. The appellee had the phone on him throughout the entire day and pulled it out to access it to check the time. It is highly unlikely that an individual will have a cell phone for merely the purpose of using as a calendar or a clock, and much more likely that they will use it for the phone's data and purpose and have the ability to access and use it.
Would it have made any difference if he had left it in his pocket all day and nobody had seen the physical object?
In other words, would it have made a difference if the government hadn't specifically said, could you get your cell phone out so we can know what the date is? Which is an interesting question.
It might have made some difference, Your Honor, if the government investigators had not already had a wealth of information that conveyed to them that Apelli had access to the phone. And that is what happened in this.
Some kind of phone. They didn't know whether that's the phone they were looking for.
They thought it was, there's some evidence in record that they thought it was some sort of disposable phone, which he evidently had.
Your Honor, Appellee's brief in page 15 actually concedes that the appellee essentially admitted ownership and access to the phone when he initially denied the investigator's request to give them the passcode verbally. Therefore, what the appellee is challenging in this case, the entry of the passcode, the investigators, in Appellee's own words, already were conveyed that information by that denial.
Was there any sense in which the passcode itself was used against the accused?
Your Honor, if I understand your question, you're asking if...
The statement that he actually made. I mean, assuming that the act of entering the passcode is somehow a statement, was that used against him?
Your Honor, all it did was give...
You understand my question, which is, I mean, isn't that the question? Is it was a testimonial? Like, was what he said used against him?
Yes, Your Honor, and I would contend no. All it did was give the government investigators access to the phone.
So are you familiar with the United States versus Green case that was cited?
The Fifth Circuit, yes, ma'am.
Okay, how would you distinguish the facts in that case from this case?
Your Honor, we would just encourage the court to recognize what they already know, that ruling is not, that has no authority, actual authority here. It's merely persuasive.
Well, in that case, there wasn't the mere fact that the person, you know, was able to open the thing. That the question there was whether it was his gun locker, right? Like whether that was his. I mean, they used the fact that he was able to get in, that he had the combination to the gun lockers to show that they were his guns.
Yes, Your Honor. However, there is a likelihood that the Pelley could have had access to a phone that wasn't his. All it told the government investigators was that it was his phone. It did not inform them that he communicated or he sent any of the text messages or emails that were on the phone. It merely conveyed access. The government would have to prove independently on its own that the Pelley was the one that conducted those acts.
So in terms of any link in the evidence permitting the government to get to the underlying contents of the phone, you're saying that essentially it was the same to the investigators whether they got a phone where the passcode had been entered and a cell phone where it had not been entered? Aren't there two very different things in the mindsets of the government? But whether they have the passcode or not entered into the phone.
Your Honor, the entry of the passcode that conveys access to the phone could be used to show that the appellee did send those things. However, the government conceded that it would not use it for that purpose at trial. And finally, Your Honors, the entry of the passcode was not compelled. As the Supreme Court held in Schmerber versus California, and as the government counsel already articulated, compulsion requires some sort of physical or moral compulsion where the defendant would prefer confession to whatever other option is available.
And what other option is available?
In this case, Your Honor, the appellee could have chosen to not enter his passcode and allowed the government to do it themselves, similar to...
Well, except the government couldn't do it, because he didn't know that.
Your Honor, I see my time is about to expire.
Please answer the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Judge. There are certainly other situations, Your Honor, where the government requests for help from defendants and they refuse, and the government has to take some other act, such as destruction of a safe or other types of things. And while this case is not exactly analogous, the defendant did not think that there was an absolute certainty he had to give the government investigators.
The government could have taken a hammer to the phone.
That wouldn't have been very effective to the government, Your Honor. I'm sorry. They were in the computer, Your Honor, yes. For the foregoing reasons, we ask that you vacate the military judge's ruling. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court will now hear for counsel from the appellee.
Chief Judge Erdman, judges of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Joshua Fix, and with my co-counsel, Captain Catherine DePaul, we represent Sergeant Edward Mitchell. Now, I have a brief roadmap that I'd like to give the court, but before I do, I would like to point out that a lot of the discussion so far has been about active production cases, and that vein of case law that derives from subpoenas by grand juries and orders by courts that are shepherded through the court system. In my argument, I would like to distinguish those cases from cases that are fundamentally about the interrogation process and the rights that everyone has regarding police interrogation.
Case instead of a Fourth Amendment. I mean, I know that it's been cast as an interrogation case, but it seems more like a Fourth Amendment case, which is they have a valid warrant, right? They want to seize this stuff and search it. They can seize it, but they can't search it because there's a passcode, right? And they need him to give it to them.
Yes, Your Honor. So it's that interesting nexus, Your Honor, between the ability of the government to lawfully search for a thing and whether or not the government can compel someone to use the contents of their mind to facilitate the government's own search.
Use the contents of your mind, we were talking before. I mean, I know that it's an old, that there's a difference between, getting a key from someone because that doesn't make them use their mind and making them give you enter the combination because then they have to use their mind. And it sort of doesn't seem like a distinction without a difference to me with all due respect to people that come up with it. You're using your key, you have to use your mind to remember where the key is, which key you're gonna use, you have to physically go and get it and turn it. I don't see how that requires any less mental effort than putting a combination.
And so I have two responses to Your Honor's question there. The first is that the short answer to why this is being phrased as a Fifth Amendment case as opposed to a Fourth Amendment case is because these are certified issues following a government interlocutory appeal on the Fifth Amendment issue.
But you would agree that we have the leeway to ask you what the real issue in the case is? It's a certified issue, right? We didn't pick it.
Yes, indeed, Your Honor. And so with respect to the key vice combination analogy, I would like to point out that that was the analogy that was conceived by the Supreme Court to explain why a pure act of production, assembling files and turning them over to the government, could be a testimonial act and implicate the Fifth Amendment. If it was sufficiently like giving a combination to a safe. And that's what the Supreme Court agreed on, that in certain cases, compiling files and turning them over to the government would be sufficiently like giving a combination to a safe to warrant Fifth Amendment protection. Well, members of the court, this is a case that actually involves giving a secret combination or producing the secret combination by punching it into the phone to facilitate government action.
Captain Fix, to follow up on Judge Ryan's question, I think she's asking a question that I have a similar interest in, and that is how the issue is framed. And let me read it to you. Whether the Fifth Amendment self-incrimination clause is violated when a suspect voluntarily opens the phone. And so my question is very simple. I look at things kind of simple way. And it seems to me that by asking the accused to open the phone, they're simply asking his consent to enter the phone. Is that kind of a, you touch upon this a little bit, I think, in your brief, saying that it wasn't voluntary.
Yes, Your Honor. So I would like to answer your...
I frame it that way because it's kind of in line with what Judge Ryan is getting at, that if you shave away all of this Fifth Amendment jurisprudence and access and what you're left with, I wonder, is simply a case where the accused had invoked right to counsel. They went in and asked him for consent to enter his phone. The question then became whether or not that consent was valid or not. If the consent was vitiated by the actions of the investigators, then what are you left with?
So, Your Honor, I would distinguish this from a consent to search case as follows. The government was not asking for consent to search here. The government did not need consent to search here. The government had a search authorization.
They had authority to search, but they asked him for entry into the phone, right?
So what they were asking for, Your Honor, was not consent to search. They were asking him to use the knowledge that only he had to facilitate their search,
okay,
which is different.
How could that be any different than if the police have a warrant to search your home, right? You have a keypad to get into your home. They say, would you enter the keypad to let us into your house, right? You know, would you help us out here, right? Because otherwise, we're just going to have to break down the door.
We're wondering if this notion of focusing on the voluntariness helps you in your case, is it irrelevant?
No, we believe that the voluntariness does help us, Your Honor, and for the following reason. The Edwards rule creates a presumption that if a suspect has invoked his right to counsel, and Sergeant Mitchell did, that statements made after that invocation are presumptively involuntary if counsel has not been provided. Counsel was.
What statement is being used against him? Right, that's the other question. Like, I agree that that's the Edwards rule, and I agree that in Hutchins, this court construed the conversation between them and his subsequent confession as being based on the way that they approached the request to search. Right, but how is this the same?
So,
would you open your phone? Would you help us out?
I mean,
they weren't saying, "Then can tell us everything," or were they? Because he didn't make a confession, he didn't make a statement. He resolutely said, "I'm not talking until I have a lawyer." All he did was do what they asked him to do, which was enter the numbers for the phone.
Well, and Your Honor, that phrasing of the facts puts what transpired quite mildly. Indeed, unlike how the government portrayed this, this wasn't the police simply coming to him and saying, "Oh, would you help us out?" They asked him whether or not he had a phone. Then they asked him, "What is the password to your phone?" He refused to.
Well, they were executing a search warrant, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Can you give us the responsive thing? So, I mean, that's not, I mean, maybe it is.
Oh, Although, Your Honor, they could have executed that search warrant without asking questions that would that would likely lead to incriminating responses.
My point is he didn't make incriminating responses.
And we would contend that he did, Your Honor. He produced the phone, first of all. Then he admitted that he knew the passcode but would not share it. And then after what at least one witness described multiple times as badgering by the police, he eventually acceded to, well, I won't share it, but I'll enter it in. And then the police had him unlock the phone. And all of these things were required the use of the contents of his mind. And, Your Honor, we would contend that it does not make a difference whether he disclosed the actual password to the police at that time, or he disclosed the password by entering it into his phone, and by then changing the settings in his phone, demonstrating that he had knowledge of the phone, possession of the phone, control of the phone, that the phone was his, that he knew how to use it, and that he excluded all others to the use of the phone. Even before we reach the issue of the contents of the phone itself, these are all the things that were expressed by the actions.
Were any of those things like at issue? Like, were any of those things contested? Did any of those things matter?
I mean,
I understand in the abstract, in some case they might. I'm asking you in this case, did they?
They could indeed, Your Honor, because the government's theory at that point was that Sergeant Mitchell was in some way using a phone to commit certain offenses. So when you're asking Sergeant Mitchell questions about, do you have a phone? Do you have the password to this phone? Will you unlock this phone? And then you compel these responses. It is indeed incriminating. One point on the fact.
And then I'll leave you alone, I think. But is it your position that if the government has a valid warrant to basically seize all electronic devices from Joe Schmuckatelli, that the police can't go to Joe Schmuckatelli and say, give us all your electronic devices?
That's
somehow seeking an incriminating response?
They could, Your Honor, but at the peril of the police, if it is in a custodial environment and Mr. Kelly, in your hypothetical, has invoked his right to counsel. So at the police's own peril, under facts similar to this case, Your Honor.
Now, so you were in your argument a moment ago, you were referring to the fact that it conveyed exclusive dominion and control over that phone. Where do you get that from? How do you know that the individual didn't share the passcode with lots of people?
Well, it's fairly implied by his actions, Your Honor. And when you're dealing with testimonial acts, you're dealing with what is fairly implied by the actions.
To what extent where phones are used from the moment someone gets up until they go to bed, and they're putting in passcodes so frequently, to what extent are they really using their mind as compared to engaging in a reflexive action, physical action, with the phone open?
Your Honor, that would likely turn on each individual. However, because of the nature of these phones, and you refer to sort of our common knowledge of the way phones are used these days, when somebody password protects a phone, they come up with the password themselves. It is the contents of their mind going into the phone. It is then using the contents of their mind to access the phone. And some people may do this relatively reflexively, but it is nevertheless the contents of their own mind that they are expressing every time they do it. Now,
go ahead.
Your Honor, I would like to turn to the issue that I intended to start with from the beginning, though, which goes back to the Edwards issue and the nature of custodial interrogation after an invocation of the right to counsel.
Do you want to start with that because you think that your Edwards issue is stronger?
I believe the MRE 305 Charlie 2 issue is stronger, Your Honor. Military Rule of Evidence 305 Charlie 2 requires suppression of the iPhone in this case because its content and its contents, because Sergeant Mitchell invoked his right to counsel before police interrogated him about the existence and the password of the iPhone. And MRE 305 Charlie 2 states that if a suspect invokes his right to counsel, any statement made in an interrogation after such request and any evidence derived from the interrogation after such request is inadmissible unless counsel was present. Furthermore,
so in that case, we would just have to agree with you that this was a reinterrogation.
Yes, Your Honor.
And your position is we apply 305 to these facts, full stop.
Yes, Your Honor. It is that simple. Particularly considering that MRE 301 alpha states, and I quote here, an individual may claim the most favorable privilege provided by the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution, Article 31, or these rules, end quote. Now, because of this,
can I just ask you one other question about the reinterrogation? What, in your view, could the police have asked him that would have been permissible? Is it your position that once someone has invoked the right to counsel, that they can't, the police can't ask them anything about anything? Because I'm pretty sure that's not the rule, so I'm just wondering what rule you would like to adopt.
So, Your Honor, the police could have announced their purpose and told him that what they were going to do was search him for his cellular phone and similar evidence. They indeed could have patted him down, Your Honor, and they do that every day.
If they were looking for a handwriting exemplar, would they have been able to do that under your approach to this case?
Yes, Your Honor, because it is well settled that handwriting exemplars, similar to the signature in the production case referenced by Judge Ryan earlier, are not testimonial because they are not conveying facts within the mind of the person giving the exemplar. They're simply used for showing how one's muscles work. It conveys no inner processes of the mind. So the government in its brief attempts to claim that MRE 305 Charlie 2 does not apply here, and it refers to the discussion section of the rules to sort of introduce ambiguity into the analysis and focuses on the stylistic language in that discussion section. But the stylistic language was actually not even included in the executive order that created this rule in its current version. However, language that was included in that executive order was a discussion section to Military Rule of Evidence 101. And that stated, and I quote, "The discussion itself does not have the force of law, even though it may describe legal requirements derived from other sources. It is in the nature of a treatise and may be used as secondary authority."
Well, do we really need to get into all that? We give statutory language, and by extension, the language of the rules. If it's non-ambiguous, it's plain meaning.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So do we really need to get into all that?
You do not, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I am offering it merely to show that even if this court did indulge that particular line of inquiry, it would find that the intended meaning and the plain meaning are indeed the same. But this court does not need to go there because there is a plain meaning to this rule. And the plain meaning is consistent with the military judge's ruling below. And for that reason, this court should affirm the findings of the military judge, or the ruling of the military judge.
Based on, I have two other questions, which is, what do we do about the standard of review, right? Which is that it's abuse of discretion with basically sort of like the thumb being on the scale of the person that won in the first instance.
Yes, Your Honor. So there are several standards of review at play here, Your Honor. And obviously the findings of fact.
What's your position about how that strengthens your position?
Oh, so resolving facts in the light most favorable to the prevailing party at trial, Your Honor, there is ample evidence to support the military judge's findings of fact and conclusions of law. To cite this court to just a few examples of those, it does not sound like there is much dispute that here today that Sergeant Mitchell was in custody, but to briefly go over those places that support that that conclusion, you can look to the fact that he was indeed in custody just an hour and a half earlier at the police station. That's Joint Appendix 123 and 124. He was escorted from the police station by a senior NCO back to that NCO's office. You can refer to Joint Appendix 156, 194, 285, and 471 for that fact. And all of these are things the military judge could rely on, and this court should resolve in the favor of the party prevailing at the court below. Further, he was ordered into his commander's office to wait for the MPs. That's at Joint Appendix 285, 288, and 471. His commander actually said at one point he was signed over to the MPs. That is at...
The facts that support the questions were reinterrogation. Is that your question of fact? Is that a question of law? Do we get to decide? Was that a reinterrogation?
That's a...
that's the question, right? I mean, I don't think anyone disagrees that he invoked, and I think that... You know, the custody findings of fact are supported by the record. What about the reinterrogation?
So the reinterrogation, Your Honor.
I mean, basically equating the things he was asked to a interrogation.
And those are going to be mixed findings of fact and law, Your Honor. The military judge made findings of fact as to what, at a minimum, the military police asked and when, and she explained those very well on the record, and then concluded that those were statements that were likely to elicit an incriminating response. And she was correct in this conclusion, particularly considering the deferential standard of review here.
What is the incriminating response that you contend was elicited?
So
this is my phone and this is my password?
Starting off with-
Here to stand my court, my problem is, I mean, Hutchins, like we had the guy gave full confession.
Right.
So like that way it was clear what the incriminating responses that were elicited from questions. Here, to my mind, it's not nearly as clear.
Well, it would start, Your Honor, and Chief Judge Erdman, I see I'm about to run out of time.
You can respond to the question.
Your Honor, it starts with simply stating, this is my phone, then admitting that he knows the password but will not divulge it, then finally coming around to entering his password into the phone, then changing the settings of his phone for the police at their request, then entering his password again. All of these are incriminating, and some of them are explicitly statements and some of them are testimonial acts, Your Honor. And considering the deferential standard of review, the military judge was correct in her findings of fact, correct in her conclusions of law. And considering that MRE 305, Charlie 2, is directly on point here, and this court need look no further, this court should affirm the ruling of the military judge. Pending any further questions.
Thank you, counsel. The court will now hear from the amicus in support of the appellee.
Chief Judge Erdman, judges, may it please the court. My name is Dominic Barcelo, and I come before you as amicus curiae in support of the appellee, Sergeant Edward Mitchell. I will be addressing the Fifth Amendment self-incrimination issue. The military judge's ruling should be upheld for two reasons. First, forcing appellee to reveal his secret passcode to his phone by entering it into his phone was a testimonial communication because it conscripted appellee to use the contents of his mind in aid of his own prosecution. Second, the forced extraction of the passcode was incriminating because it formed an essential link in the chain of evidence necessary to prosecute Sergeant Mitchell. Absolutely, Your Honor. Link in the chain has its origins in United States v. Hoffman. There, the court held that evidence, in order to be incriminating for the purposes of the Fifth Amendment, evidence need not itself be incriminating so long as it provides an essential link in the chain of evidence. Now, this is expanded on by the court in Hubble. There, the Supreme Court explained that the Fifth Amendment protection encompasses compelled statements that lead to the discovery of incriminating evidence, even though statements themselves are not incriminating and not introduced into evidence.
So your view then is just because the statement, I take it, is the entry of the number. And so your point, I guess, then, is that that gave them access to the phone. And if they hadn't had access to the phone, but for the access to the phone, they wouldn't have been able to search the phone, and therefore that's the link?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Without the PIN code providing access to the phone, they would never have access to the contents of the phone, which are the question being suppressed here today. Returning to the first point, the testimonial nature of the passcode, the parties in this case have focused on the active production aspect of the passcode, and will we fully support the appellee's compelling arguments on this matter and would be happy to discuss them further if that would please the court. We seek to present an equally compelling argument, a ground for affirmance independent of the active production doctrine, because the passcode was in and of itself a testimonial communication. The Supreme Court has explained that the expression of the contents of an individual's mind is testimonial for the purposes of the Fifth Amendment. Similarly, this court has explained that the Fifth Amendment privilege requires that personal knowledge be disclosed. Here, the appellee revealed the contents of his mind and disclosed personal knowledge when he entered the passcode into his phone.
Any personal knowledge? Is it any content of the mind? Or doesn't it have to be the sort of statement that the Fifth Amendment is supposed to protect, right? Which is an incriminating statement.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And this was incriminating.
And it was incriminating because it ended up leading to...
As a link in the chain, Your Honor. Exactly.
So you're basing your argument really on Supreme Court's holding in Hubble.
Hubble, backed by the starting with Hoffman, was that originated. But the 11th Circuit in their In Re Grand Jury case has also applied the link in the chain analysis to a decryption passcode specifically. If you look there, you will see that the 11th Circuit explained that even if decryption and production of the contents of the hard drives in that case themselves are not incriminatory, they are a link in the chain of evidence designed to lead to incriminating evidence, precisely what occurred here, and that this is sufficient to invoke the Fifth Amendment privilege.
Counsel, the amicus Electronic Frontier Foundation, or whatever their name is, talked about encryption and the fact that when this stuff's sitting in there, it's gibberish. It's ununderstandable gibberish, but that the act of opening it up not only opens, but converts the gibberish into something understandable. Does that have any constitutional significance?
We believe it does, Your Honor. We believe because decryption, like our fellow Amici EFF, that because decryption is not just a mere unlocking or a simple providing of documents, it's a translation of the contents of the documents. Like you explained, encryption, when encrypted contents are on a phone, they essentially don't exist for any practical purposes. If the government could have somehow unlocked Sergeant Mitchell's phone and kept the decrypted contents, that it would have been totally useless for them. It would have been as if it was a bunch
It might be more convincing if it was a two-step process, you know, open phone, decrypt, but it seems to be automatic. So,
Your Honor, that's correct. No, the unlocking of the phone and the decryption occur at the same time. Right. What's important here is that the decryption actually translates the information into a usable format.
Well, the brief seemed to be saying that until you open the thing, there's nothing for the government to look for. Presumably, perhaps within the context of search authorization, because it's meaningless gibberish. I don't know about that. But anyway, go ahead.
That's my understanding of encryption as well, Your Honor. While the phone's contents are encrypted, they're essentially useless for the government. And that's why it goes to the testimony.
Or
anybody else, precisely. And that's why it goes to the testimonial nature, because it's a translation, not just a simple provision.
But I mean, in terms of the translation, I mean, the fact that person's putting the thing in, the way that you talk about it in your brief is that it was like somehow his mind that was like inside the computer undoing all this gibberish and making it, turning it back into what it was. I mean, is that what you're trying to say?
Fundamentally, Your Honor, yes. It's a simple process for us. All we have to do is enter our passcodes into our phone and the contents are decrypted. However, it's only that passcode that can decrypt the contents. And this was a passcode that Sergeant Mitchell created in his own mind. It was not something that was provided when he got the phone. And it was located, for the purposes of the investigation, only in his mind. The government knew no other way that they could access the phone.
Let me ask you a question that has nothing to do with the iPhone. Okay, let me go back to, I think, the example that I talked about before, because this goes back to my sort of Fourth Amendment issue or my question about, like, what are the limits? Okay, let's say instead of a phone, someone comes up to your house, they have a warrant to search your house, you have a keypad on your door, right? So I'm the police, I can just break down your door if I want to, but instead I decide to be polite. And I say, you know, hey, could you help me out? Like, can you help me out? You know, enter the code to the door. And you go, no. You know, can you help me out? I got a warrant. You know, and ultimately, you help me out and you enter the code. Is that an incriminating statement too?
If that was compelled and the entry of the passcode led to incriminating evidence that the government could not have received from some independent source, then yes, that would be incriminating, Your Honor.
So to your mind, then, it would always be better. I mean, I understand, you know, if you get into the iPhone, right? So that's a different situation. But so to your mind, it's a better practice then for police to just break down the door.
For the purpose...
No questions, no anything, just go break down the door. No, would you help us out, enter the key, you know, help us out and enter down so we don't have to break down your door because we've got a warrant.
For the purposes of protecting individuals' Fifth Amendment rights, yes, it would be better for them to break down the door than to force someone to aid in their own prosecution by providing a passcode and entry to their home for investigators.
Let me change it a little bit more, and then I think that Sparks has a question. So do you have a position then as to whether, assuming that someone has a valid warrant, right? Because once you have a warrant, you'd agree that you're allowed to search.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right, and seize whatever you were told you could search and seize. Is it your position then that if someone wanted to, you know, build a moat and have spring guns and pit bulls and everything, like, you know, go ahead, search my house if you can, that they can do that?
Your Honor, I would have to think about that a little more to determine. Focus is more on the Fourth Amendment aspects here.
This whole consent dead horse that no one seems to be wanting to give me and Judge Ryan any love on, but the issue I have, I've heard you talk about the access to this phone, but it still sounds to me like this is a request to have you consent to enter my phone. And it goes back, I'm curious about, I know this isn't your line of argument, but I'm stuck on this, and so I gotta get unstuck. And my issue is, why isn't this just the investigators asking for consent, even though they have a warrant? They have a warrant to seize his phone and get into it. It's different, I think, and maybe you won't or will not agree, with Judge Ryan's hypothetical with the house. At least we know they can bust down the door and get in the house. Here it seems not so clear that they can enter the phone, so to speak, without access to this code. And so what do you think about this theory? I'm looking for some
absolutely, Your Honor.
Help here.
I do not believe that this was a simple asking, the investigators asking for consent. If they had wanted to ask for consent, they could have done so, but that's not what occurred here. What occurred was first they asked for the passcode itself and he refused.
Let me ask you, does that make your case stronger? Does it hurt your case or help your case looking at it from a consent issue or?
I
get the feeling from both you and your colleague that this is not helpful to your case, but.
Your Honor, I see my time is, thank you, Your Honor. I can't speak to how it would help the Fourth Amendment issue, Your Honor. I don't think it would help our Fifth Amendment issue because if it was a simple consent search, if it was a simple asking for consent, it would not require the use of the contents of the mind and therefore not be testimonial for the Fifth Amendment.
Right, but if it was consent, and it was bad consent was vitiated, wouldn't that be favorable to your side of the issue?
For the purpose of the Fourth Amendment?
Fourth Amendment, yes.
I suppose it would, Your Honor, because then the government, the it would...
Wouldn't they have to then rely on the inevitability that they would have found the evidence, but for the access code?
Yes, Your Honor. For the purposes of the Fourth Amendment, if he had just simply given them consent to search and then they had been unable to do so because of the encryption, then it would not have been inevitable that they would have received it, then it would have supported our argument.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So you may briefly summarize.
Your Honor, for the Supreme Court has explained that the purpose of the Fifth Amendment is to ensure that the government shoulders the entire burden of the prosecution. This is not what occurred here. Here, investigators conscripted appellee to aid in his own prosecution by providing his passcode. And for these reasons, we respectfully ask the court to affirm the military judge's ruling. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll now hear a rebuttal. And counsel, before you get going, I'd like you to respond to the arguments we've heard on MRE 305C2 and why that should not mean what it appears to say.
Yes, Your Honor. Important to that, though, is what it does say. What it says is that there has to be interrogation. And so the argument is the same as it would be under Edwards, whether Sergeant Mitchell in this case was in fact interrogated. Under Morris, under Frazier, very analogous cases in which there was a request for consent.
If this were an interrogation, 305C2 would apply.
There would be error, but United States versus Patain says that derivative evidence that comes from this type of an error is not suppressed. And the president did not intend...
Well, 305 applied to United States v. Haynes. Or is that where'd that case come from?
That's an Edwards case. Or excuse, it's a Miranda case.
Sure. It's a Miranda case. Yeah, yes. No. Addressed, you know...
The military context.
The military context.
Yes, sir. Our position is that the president did not intend to overrule Patain with this, what was supposed to be a simply stylistic change.
What do you base that on?
It purports to state the Fifth Amendment right to counsel in its title. It's supposed to be just spelling out the Fifth Amendment right to counsel. What it spells out is something very different.
Because, it's more expansive. And I mean, the president, if he wants to, can give more rights to service members than the Constitution or the Supreme Court. Can't he?
Certainly he could, but our position, he did not intend to in this case. It was not his purpose.
But if he did, then you should write him a letter.
But that's correct. If he did, if the president did, it does extend to derivative evidence.
Okay.
Counsel, you keep on focusing on the request aspect, even in the 305 context. But if the police say, could you please confess to this murderer? We're going to have to find other evidence against you. That's a request. So what's the distinction?
It would be, but it would be a request to interrogate. It would be a request that satisfies the test of Rhode Island versus Innis and qualifies as interrogation. By contrast, this court has said a request for consent to search, like in this case, this request to unlock the phone, does not satisfy that test, does not satisfy the Innis test in Morris and Frazier. So whether it's 305, whether it's Edwards in this case, if it's not interrogation, it's not error.
So it's really not a request distinction, it's an interrogation distinction.
Correct, Your Honor. And a request for consent to search is not an interrogation. I'd like to just very briefly try and answer Judge Ryan's question from before. If it did matter whose phone it was, something like that, an easy example would be a single cell phone discovered in a dorm room with two occupants in it, where the government does not know who the phone belongs to. That would change the analysis because it wouldn't be a foregone conclusion that either one of those roommates knows the passcode, and it would potentially, depending on the circumstances, be incriminating. Whereas here, that's not the case. Here, the moment that phone came out of Sergeant Mitchell's pocket, it was a foregone conclusion as to the government that he had access to that phone. Pending any further questions.
Thank you, counsel. The court thanks counsel for all of the parties. The case is now submitted, and the court is in recess until further order of the court.